Chapter 7 Black Holes.
Nur Agha could feel the shackles digging into his wrists. First one arm was yanked upward, then the other. Blindfolded, he still knew what was coming. It was a familiar script, a nightmarish play. Arms reached around his waist, hoisted him up, and then released him. He dropped down until the dangling ceiling chains caught, and he was left there hanging, waiting for the door to open again. When it did, he heard footsteps and then a deep, low growl. The dog's teeth cut into his leg, and he tried to cry out, but with his gag he could not. Soon he was bitten again. When he was finally untied and brought down, the blindfold was removed, and he blinked at the American soldiers standing around him. They asked about Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, about names he'd never heard. They were not at all pleased with his responses. Nur Agha was in a quandary. He had served with the Afghan National Police in Gardez, a mud-cake town in the southeastern part of the country, in a unit with a well-known anti-Taliban history. He and his friends had opposed the Taliban during the 1990s, and when the United States invaded, he had assured friends that America will save us. Nonetheless, one summer day in 2003, he had been arrested without explanation. By now, he'd been in captivity at a tiny U.S. base for more than a week. Back in the interrogation room the following day, he found himself kneeling on a long wooden bar with his hands tied to a pulley above. He was then pushed back and forth, the bar rolling across his shins as the interrogators asked their questions over his screams. The following day, he was lying with his back against the wooden floor as soldiers stood over him. His mouth was pried open, and bottle after bottle of water was poured down his throat. He felt as if his stomach were about to burst, and then blacked out. When he awoke, he vomited uncontrollably. The questions continued. It took another week for his transfer to the main prison at Bagram, where, to his great relief, the interrogators came less frequently. He was never told why he had been detained. One day, just as mysteriously, he was handed a letter acknowledging his wrongful imprisonment and told to go home. Nur Agha's path signaled the moral morass that the American mission was sinking into. At every step, the United States may have been the hapless victim of Afghan strongmen, but it was also setting the rules of the game, and then following those rules through to their logical bloody conclusions. The war on terror had become an end in itself, the ultimate self-fulfilling prophecy. His story begins in the district of Zurmat, where the highlands of the southeastern Afghan-Pakistani border give way to the broad floodplains of the interior. With its neat bazaars and roadside soda vendors, its rectilinear farming plots and fields of apricot and apple, Zurmat had the look of an ideal summer destination for future Western tourists, had it not also been home to the Shaikot Valley, a rocky imposing gorge that offered the perfect redoubt for retreating armies. After the U.S. invasion, a few hundred Taliban and Al-Qaeda fighters holed up in its snowy summits under the command of local Taliban leader Saifur Rahman Mansur. Far from home and fearful of traveling into Pakistan, the fighters were low on options, so Mansur sent a letter to the Afghan government offering talks to end his armed defiance of the interim administration. Secret negotiations were launched, but with Kabul and Washington in no mood for reconciliation, the initiative quickly collapsed. U.S. troops stormed the valley in a campaign dubbed Operation Anaconda, the American military's largest set-piece battle since the first Gulf War. In a decisive victory, Mansur was killed, along with dozens or perhaps hundreds of enemy fighters. 8 U.S. soldiers and an unknown number of civilians also lost their lives. After Anaconda, Zurmat was etched into American minds as a Taliban haven, and the small district had indeed produced more Taliban than any other outside the Deep South, earning it the sobriquet Little Kandahar. But much as in post-2001 Kandahar, the Taliban in Zurmat, with the sole exception of Mansur's crew, had retired to their homes. The most prominent to abandon the movement was Taliban cleric Khalilullah Firozi, who openly supported Karzai and was entreating others to do likewise. Early on, however, Firozi's home was raided and he was imprisoned by U.S. forces. It would be the first in a series of raids over the coming year against anyone understood to have been even remotely connected to the ancient regime. American troops invaded the dwelling of a prominent pro-government preacher, Mullah Ayatollah, on the mistaken impression that he opposed Karzai. They stormed the home of Haji Wodin, a popular philanthropist and comedian. They burst into the residence of well-known Taliban defector, Abdul Ghaffar Akhundzadeh, who, assuming thieves had broken in, scrambled up to the roof and opened fire on the intruders. The Americans returned fire, prompting a neighbor, under the impression that the village was under attack from thieves or a rival clan, to run to the mosque and implore fellow villagers over the loudspeaker to rush to Akhundzadeh's defense. Neighbors started shooting from their homes. Soon the Americans had a full-fledged battle on their hands. They called in air support. And only then did Akhundzadeh realize that these were in fact foreign troops. He turned himself in and was sent to Guantanamo Bay. Through the decades of war, Afghans had survived by knowing where they stood, by calibrating themselves to power, the only sure bet in the frequent U-turns of Afghan history. In Zermatt, this was now proving impossible. "We didn't understand this new government or who it supported," said a ref, a local mullah. "We supported them, but they targeted religious people. No one could understand it. I myself fled to Pakistan. We lived every day in fear." If reconciled Taliban were in the crosshairs, Dr. Hafizullah figured he would fare better. A distinguished tribal elder with a long anti-Taliban track record, Hafizullah had come to prominence during the anti-Russian jihad. Afterward, he had established a small pharmacy, which, in the education-deprived countryside, was enough to earn him the honorific of doctor. Under Taliban rule, he had been imprisoned and tortured for refusing to comply with their social edicts. After 2001, he won a tribal election and became Zermatt's first post-Taliban governor. By all accounts a popular and competent official, Hafizullah was nonetheless an early victim of Kabul politicking, and in mid-2002, he was replaced with a Karzai flunky. Under the new administration, crimes soared. Rogue police units terrorized the local highways, shaking down motorists and robbing merchants at gunpoint. As the district descended into open banditry, the government formed an emergency task force and called upon Dr. Hafizullah to head it. His commission established a criminal investigations team, the first of its kind in the area, and launched a crackdown against growing anti-government sentiment, decreeing that anyone caught opposing Kabul would have his house burned down, a local tribal custom, and be fined nearly $50,000. These were, to be sure, not the actions of a Taliban supporter, yet this was exactly how Hafizullah would be branded. The criminal investigations had turned over a stone too many to suit the powers that be, and things came to a head when his commission initiated a probe into a reported theft of $3,000 from local shopkeepers. Hafizullah tracked down the getaway car sitting brazenly by the main police station, a facility under the command of Abdullah Mujahid, a key American ally. He confronted the police chief, in public no less, and forced him to repay the victims. Mujahid swiftly secured his revenge, informing the Americans that Hafizullah was a Taliban double agent. The ex-governor was promptly detained by U.S. troops under accusations of providing operational and logistical support for al-Qaeda operations. A rash of wild charges followed, including an allegation that the $3,000 that he had recovered had in fact come from terrorists. He was banished to Guantanamo. With Dr. Hafizullah out of the picture, Zermatt had lost a key point of state access. Fortunately for the district, another still remained. Commander Naim was an eminent tribal elder who had been elected security chief of Zermatt following the Russian departure, stayed on through the Taliban years, and was re-elected in 2002. An ardent supporter of the Americans and one of the most popular figures in Zermatt, he nonetheless discovered one day that some men under his command had been detained by U.S. troops. When Naim showed up to ask why, he too was arrested, blindfolded, and handcuffed. "They stripped me naked, out in the open, where everyone could see," he told a reporter. "I was thinking that these are infidels who have come to a Muslim country to imprison us, just like the Russians." Taken from one base to the next, Naeem eventually found himself shackled in the wire mesh cages of Kandahar Airfield. "We were without hope because we were innocent," he recalled. "I was very sad because I could not see my children, family, friends. But what could we do?" Like Hafizullah, he was sent to Guantanamo. Naeem's downfall could be traced to Mullah Qasim's, a longtime rival and Taliban follower who had reconciled with the new government and passed along the spurious intelligence that Naeem was a terrorist. Soon, however, U.S. military officials got wise to Mullah Qasim's Taliban past and descended upon his village to arrest him. The crafty mullah, however, had already fled to Pakistan. The Americans nonetheless detained a farmer named Qasim's, mistaking him for the mullah. He too was shipped to Guantanamo. With Zurmat's two most influential pro-government figures, Naeem and Hafizullah, out of the way, the road to power was open to anyone who had the Americans' ear. For a time, Samud Khan, a small-time commander who led a unit paid for by the U.S. Special Forces, played this game as well as anyone. He was expert in picking off rivals left and right by branding them as Al-Qaeda, while indulging in a variety of unsavory activities, not least his predilection for younger boys. He forcibly kept a pair, T-boys in the local argot, with his unit. One day, however, he made the mistake of picking a fight with another local strongman who boasted ties of his own with the Americans. Soon, Khan himself was accused of supporting Al-Qaeda, and in the usual turn of events, was arrested, beaten, and sent on to Bagram. 8 members of his unit, meanwhile, were rounded up and delivered to Guantanamo. Among them was one of those T-boys, Asadullah. At 12 years old, he became the prison's youngest inmate. The U.S. forces' conviction that the enemy threat was real, though there were no Taliban or Al-Qaeda to be found, deepened when Pacha Khan Zadran, an anti-Taliban warlord, turned against the Karzai government. Although he had been financed by U.S. special forces, Zadran rebelled against Kabul when he was not awarded the governorship of 3 southeastern provinces. Soon his men were getting into skirmishes with U.S. troops, even as he continued to denounce his own enemies as Taliban and Al-Qaeda. Rocket fire began to rain down upon American camps, and it grew even easier to manipulate U.S. troops with spurious intelligence. By the end of 2002, the twisted skein of alliances and betrayals had become impossible to disentangle. Take the case of Commander Paré, an anti-Taliban militiaman who controlled a checkpoint at a mountain pass near Zurmat. Paré cooperated with the Americans, but ran afoul of Police Chief Abdullah Mujahid, the official who had stolen $3,000 from Zurmat shopkeepers and other government figures. In short order, he was tricked into having tea with members of the Alabama National Guard's 20th Special Forces Group, who arrested him along with his entire unit. At a nondescript U.S.-run prison, Paré was forced to kneel on stones until he lost all sensation in his legs. At one point, his toenail was ripped off by an interrogator. He and the others were kicked, whipped with cables, and hosed with water. After a week, Paré's younger brother, Jamal Nasir, could barely walk. On a cold spring morning, complaining of intense abdominal pain, he asked to go to the bathroom. As 2 others supported him, Nasir's body suddenly went limp, and soon afterwards his heart stopped. He had been tortured to death. After 2 weeks of abuse, Paré and the others were dropped off at one of Mujahid's prisons. The police chief had consigned many a soul to American abuse, but the sight of those battered, near-death captives was too much even for him, and he petitioned for their release. In the eyes of the U.S. Special Forces, this constituted a grave betrayal, and a relationship that had already been souring took a dangerous turn. Almost overnight, he was recast in the role of a man with questionable loyalties, a government official soft on terrorism. In a meeting attended by Mujahid and UN officials, an American officer threatened to kill him if he sided with those opposing the coalition. The very structures that Mujahid had so ruthlessly exploited were about to turn on him. Soon he lost his post as police chief and was reassigned to a sinecure in Kabul. Months later, he was visiting home for a wedding when American soldiers dropped by and invited him to review intelligence at their base. Like so many others, Mujahid fell for the ruse of friendship and soon found himself locked up in a cage in Bagram. "They didn't allow us to sleep at all for 13 days, he recalled. Whenever he dozed off, a guard would strike his legs. Heavy metal music blared through the corridors. In the fleeting moments of silence, he could hear moans and cries, but could not see where from. One day, soldiers appeared at his cage, and he was hauled outside and loaded onto an aircraft. They would not say where he was going. Many hours later, the plane landed at another prison, where the air felt thick and wet. Mujahid was led through a row of cages as inmates in white and orange jumpsuits banged on the wire mesh and shouted, "This is Guantanamo! You are in Guantanamo!" In a sort of perverse poetic justice, he wound up in a cell near Dr. Hafizullah's. While seizing Mujahid, the Americans also apprehended a number of his men, including drivers, cooks, and guards. Among them was Nur Agha. Years later, still battling memories of days spent hanging from a prison ceiling, he offered an epitaph for Zurmat and its environs. "There was no one left standing in the end. It was as if the whole system just devoured everyone." Dr. Hafizullah, Zurmat's first governor, had ended up in Guantanamo because he'd crossed Police Chief Mujahid. Mujahid wound up in Guantanamo because he crossed the Americans. Security Chief Naeem found himself in Guantanamo because of an old rivalry with Mullah Qasim. Qasim eluded capture, but an unfortunate soul with the same name ended up in Guantanamo in his place. And a subsequent feud left Samud Khan, another pro-American commander, in Bagram prison, while the boy his men had sexually abused was shipped to Guantanamo. No one in this group had been a member of the Taliban or Al-Qaeda. Some, like Abdullah Mujahid and Samud Khan, certainly should have been brought to justice, but that was not Guantanamo's purpose. Others, like Commander Naeem, were precisely the sort of pro-government figures that Washington had wanted to see at the helm of the new Afghanistan. Instead, Zurmat's mood of hope and reconciliation was rapidly giving way to one of rebellion. Years later, Dr. Hafizullah and Commander Naeem were finally transferred from Guantanamo to Afghan government custody, and then released following intense tribal pressure. Dr. Hafizullah returned to his pharmacy, while Naeem resumed his role as tribal elder and mediator. But one winter night in 2009, the Americans came again for Hafizullah. He was led away in a hood and locked up in Bagram, where he still remains. He faces the usual set of charges, although Afghan officials and even some Western authorities vehemently deny their accuracy. The following year, Naeem attended a meeting with the governor to discuss how they could convince insurgents to come in from the cold and support the government. Upon leaving, he was arrested by American special forces. Angry protests swept the province, and merchants carried out a 3-day general strike in his support. But Naeem, too, remains in Bagram to this day. Far in the northeast, some 150 miles from Zurmat as the crow flies, in a deep valley of alder and white poplar, dotted with small stone and timber houses, lies what was, for a time, one of the most dangerous corners of the planet for an American. The Korangal Valley was Afghanistan's Fallujah, a crucible for every flavor of radical Islamist the world over, an insurgent stronghold where more American soldiers met their end than almost anywhere outside the Deep South. When I first heard about the Korangal, I had, like most observers, chalked up the trouble to obdurate mountain folk and their preternatural hostility to foreigners. After all, the people of Pech, the broader valley system in which the Korangal lies, had been among the first to rebel against the Russians. But then I learned that they had resisted the Taliban as well, partly because, in addition to the usual excesses, the Taliban had clamped down on the timber trade, the lifeblood for these logging communities. It turned out, in fact, that Pech had actually welcomed U.S. forces with open arms, and that elders and community leaders had once jostled for access to the Americans. When things changed, it began with a single man. The venerable Rahullah Wakil was the tribal leader who followed the ultra-conservative strain of Islam found in Saudi Arabia. With sharp, thoughtful eyes, an aquiline nose, and a head of thinning salt and pepper hair, Wakil exuded distinction. Indeed, Wakil, lawmaker, had been appended to his name upon his election to Kunar's parliament in 1993, when the province briefly broke away to form its own mini-state. Although he came from a line of fighters, his uncle was a locally renowned mujahid, Wakil had a softer edge, opting for a politician's life. Despite his conservative background, Wakil had fiercely opposed the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, in part because his uncle had been assassinated in 1991 by an Arab at the behest, Wakil believed, of Osama bin Laden. The Al-Qaeda leader was at the time friendly with the family's bitter enemy, radical Islamist Gulbuddin Hekmatyar. When the Taliban swept through the province in the late 1990s, Wakil's tribesmen were among the first to rally against them, taking to the mountains in a bloody guerrilla campaign. Wakil soon joined the pro-Western Northern Alliance and later took a job with the United Nations. In 2002, he was elected to the Loya Jirga, where he delivered an impassioned speech in front of thousands, championing Karzai and the new government. With the coalition forces on the ground in Pech, the contracting money began to flow in. Wakil drew his share, hundreds of thousands of dollars from the British to help eradicate poppies. With such sums sloshing around, however, entrepreneurs and carpetbaggers of all shapes and sizes soon found their way to the Americans. Among them was Malik Zarin, a timber baron and tribal elder with an eye for whatever the foreign troops happened to be looking for, who quickly maneuvered his way into their good graces. With his starched vests and jet-black, tightly cropped beard, Zarin must have cut an impressively modern figure for the Americans in the backwaters of Pech, an impression no doubt bolstered by his special connection to U.S. troops, his English-speaking sons. In a heartbeat, he became a key supplier of materials and logistics as the Americans built up their presence in the area. A not-so-subtle rivalry sprouted between Zarin and Wakil for contracting dollars and American access. With their sizable tribal influence, the two elders might have been a rich source of stability in the new Afghanistan. Wakil, in particular, was a striking image of exactly the type of ally Washington said it sought: reliably anti-Taliban, no trail of human rights abuses, and popular enough to bring America's message to the hinterlands. But the system in place did not reward stability, legitimacy, or popularity. Instead, it rewarded those who could serve up enemies, and that was Zarin's game. On an August evening in 2002, Wakil hosted a gathering in his home that included the governor of Kunar province and other key power brokers. The first grumblings of discontent with the Americans were already surfacing. Patrolling U.S. troops had twice shot and killed local Afghans carrying Kalashnikovs, mistaking them for enemy fighters. Wakil had convened the meeting to convince the local elite to placate their followers and redoubt support for the American troops, who represented, in his words, Afghanistan's only hope. The following day, he went to the nearby American base, asking the soldiers there to cooperate more closely with him, to avoid such missteps in the future. As he left, he and his aides were stopped and cuffed. "Nothing made sense," he said later. "I just couldn't understand it." In Bagram, following the usual pattern, they were interrogated and abused. Wakil was then shipped to Guantanamo. There, he was accused of supporting the followers of Hekmatyar, who by 2002 had turned against the Americans, an allegation ignoring the fact that a large part of the province's recent history had consisted of a long, bloody campaign against Hekmatyar by Wakil's party. He was also accused of opposing the Karzai government, of which he was actually a member, of being on the one hand a Wahhabi, a member of a hardline Islamist sect associated with the Saudis and Al-Qaeda, and yet simultaneously of being part of a secret movement opposing the Wahhabis, and of taking, along with his rival Zarin, $12,000 from Pakistani intelligence in order to finance military operations against the government, and to disrupt the Loya Jirga, the Grand Assembly to which he'd been elected and at which he had spoken so stirringly. Wakil appeared before a tribunal in Guantanamo to answer these Byzantine and bizarre allegations. "If somebody is a leader of a tribe and that person is a bad guy, maybe the tribe would trust him one time. The tribe would not trust him again and again and again," he said, according to the transcript of his testimony. I had been representative of my tribe since the Soviet Union left Afghanistan. He told the panel how he had been elected nearly a dozen times, and how he had worked with the coalition forces. I am so upset about the first court, he said, referring to a previous tribunal at Guantanamo, because they called me an enemy combatant. I do not accept that. I do not believe that. The court told me that I was a threat to America and that I would remain a detainee. Now I am facing you, and I assure you, I give you my word, I have been wrongly judged. I am not an American detainee. I am not an Afghan detainee. I am a detainee because of my personal rivalries. In the end, the evidence looked so flimsy that even the Guantanamo tribunal members were apparently left bemused. I just cannot help but ask, an official said in a hearing, why are you here? Nevertheless, Wakil remained in Guantanamo for 5 years. Wakil's friend and colleague Sabarlal, who had many brushes with death in the mountains fighting against the Taliban in the 1990s, also found himself in Guantanamo. In a similar tribunal hearing, he noted the paradox of his predicament. All I can tell you is that I fought for 6 years against the Taliban. I killed a lot of them. It was so ironic that I see a Talib, and then I see myself here too. I am in the same spot as a Talib. I see those people on an everyday basis. They say, see, you got what you deserve. You are here too. I asked Michael Semple, then a senior United Nations representative for Eastern Afghanistan, about Wakil. He replied, it was utterly preposterous. He was calling us every day, giving us intelligence. He was working with us. And all of a sudden he was declared an enemy? As a UN official, Semple dealt with delegation after delegation after delegation of people coming to say, tell us what is Haji Rahula's crime so we can go home. Otherwise, release him. If you really want to get an idea of our powerlessness and the powerlessness of the host authority, the Afghan government, this is a great example. None of us could do anything to get him. He just disappeared into a black hole. During Wakil's absence, a vital link between his tribal community and the government was severed, the first in a series of steps that pushed them out of the political marketplace. Wakil's faction was fully engaged, part of the political process, Semple told me. But after he was taken off the scene, his followers all ended up inside the armed resistance. Within weeks of his arrest, the first rocket started to fall on U.S. outposts in the area. Tit-for-tat shootings between Americans and angry villagers mounted. Then one day, again, acting on Zarin's intelligence, U.S. forces bombed the home of a prominent timber baron in the Korengal Valley, killing his family members. The deaths came just as the Afghan government was starting to clamp down on illegal logging. Soon, one village after another turned to open insurrection. Meanwhile, the profits continued to pour into Malik Zarin's coffers, to the point where a U.S. embassy cable could describe him as one of the wealthiest men in eastern Afghanistan. In the new Afghanistan, however, war had a way of catching up, even with the winners. In 2011, Zarin, by then in his 70s, embraced a guest at a tribal meeting. The man had hidden explosives underneath his waistcoat. The suicide blast killed Zarin instantly. Rahula Wakil was finally freed from Guantanamo in 2008, returning to assume the role of tribal leader and mediating in Kabul on behalf of his constituents. But in 2009, amid debate in Washington over the possible closure of Guantanamo, the Pentagon leaked a report to the New York Times claiming that Wakil was one of 74 former inmates suspected of having returned to terrorism, even though he was living openly and peacefully in Kabul, advising President Karzai. Leaving nothing to chance, everywhere he goes, Wakil now carried a sheaf of legal documents detailing his innocence. For 6 years, I was ready to go to court and defend myself. They should show the world their proof against me, he told a reporter. I am ready to answer any question. There was reason enough for him to worry. On a similar Pentagon list were Dr. Hafizullah and Commander Naeem, the two wrongfully imprisoned and subsequently rearrested Zurmat elders. And then there was the fate of Sabarlal. Because of Taliban threats, upon his release from Guantanamo, he was forced to relocate from Pech to the eastern city of Jalalabad. Whenever I visited him, he spoke ruefully of the years he'd lost to Guantanamo's island cage, and vowed to stay away from public life altogether. Late one night in 2011, however, U.S. soldiers stormed his home and dragged Sabarlal out of his bedroom. What happened next is unclear. Relatives and the night watchman claimed that he was blindfolded and executed, while a coalition forces spokesman said that he was shot dead because he was carrying a weapon. Afterward, the coalition announced that a key affiliate of the Al-Qaeda network had been killed. It was a curious charge against a man who had complained often to me about the militants' threats on his life. If you were unfortunate enough to get caught up in this universe of rivalry and intrigue, and then fall into American hands, you would first find yourself at one of a series of small U.S. military outposts deep in the countryside, known as field detention sites. Interrogators there typically would have a limited grasp of Afghan politics, and intelligence would be poorly shared, so epic confusions usually ensued. The unit apprehending you might have a relationship with one strongman, for instance, while you worked for another strongman, tied to a different wing of the U.S. military or the CIA. In this way, hundreds of Afghans working for pro-American commanders wound up ensnared by one of the coalition's many tentacles. And once branded as a terrorist, no amount of evidence or good sense could save you. From the field detention site, you would be shipped to one of the main prisons at either Bagram or Kandahar Airfield. You would then be questioned by a new set of interrogators who made little attempt to reconcile existing intelligence with any fresh information that they obtained. Your journey would likely end here, locked away for months or even years, unless you were one among the 200 Afghans destined for Guantanamo. There you would be assessed by officers even farther removed from the battlefield, with even foggier knowledge of the country's politics. A result of this cascade of bureaucratic inefficiencies was that only a handful of Guantanamo's Afghan inmates would turn out to be Taliban members of any import. Reading the official list of charges against the rest gives a sense of the farce the system had become. One inmate was accused, among other crimes, of supporting the political organization of Ahmed Shah Massoud, the pro-Western Northern Alliance leader murdered by Al-Qaeda. Another was alleged to have been a member of Harakat-e-Inqilabi, an anti-Soviet Mujahideen group backed by the United States that had been defunct since the mid-1990s. Inmate Mohammed Nassim arrived at Guantanamo accused of working as a deputy to Rashid Dostum, the pro-U.S. warlord and former Gilam Jam militia leader who, prison authorities mistakenly believed, had defected to the Taliban in 1998, or so Nassim's classified file stated. In fact, Dostum had been a member of the Northern Alliance and a staunch anti-Taliban fighter, even winding up on the CIA payroll during the 2001 invasion. Nassim was also accused of being the former Taliban Deputy Minister of Education, even though records indicate there was no person by that name in that position. Abdullah Khan found himself in Guantanamo, charged with being Khairullah Khairikwa, the former Taliban Minister of the Interior, which might have been more plausible if Khairikwa had not also been in Guantanamo at the time. Swat Khan's internment stemmed from an accusation that he was a high-ranking member of an anti-coalition militia known as the Mujahideen Union. In reality, at the time of his arrest, the union was a collection of pro-U.S. militiamen in the pay of the CIA. "We worked for the Americans," said Malam John, one of Khan's comrades. "We met them regularly to get instructions and give intelligence." Khan's charge sheet also alleged that he worked simultaneously for a pair of commanders who were in fact long-standing rivals. In his initial questioning, Khan was hung by his wrists from the ceiling. Later in Guantanamo, he attempted suicide. "It's all there when I close my eyes," he told me after his release. "The nightmare never leaves me." Ajib Ismallah, the director of transportation for the government of Helmand province, found himself in Guantanamo because of his close ties to Sher Mohammad Akhundzada, the province's U.S.-backed governor. According to Bismillah's classified detainee file, American authorities mistakenly asserted that the governor was originally the Taliban's second-in-command in the Helmand province. In fact, the Akhundzada family had been the Taliban's principal enemies in Helmand during the 1990s, precisely the reason why he became governor after their overthrow. This was open public knowledge, but evidently no one along the chain of detentions from Helmand to Guantanamo bothered to check. Meanwhile, certain U.S. units were detaining scores of Helmand farmers on precisely the contrary charge, opposing Governor Akhundzada, who was working closely with the Americans to consolidate his power. Bismillah's file stated that his intelligence value came not from any possible details that he could furnish about terrorists, but from his knowledge of biographical data on political figures in the new Afghan government. Just the sort of information that should have saved him from Cuba in the first place. 9 Guantanamo inmates claimed the most striking proof of all that they were not Taliban or Al-Qaeda. They had passed directly from a Taliban jail to American custody after 2001. Abdul Rahim Al-Janko, a Syrian, had arrived in Afghanistan in 2000, fleeing a troubled home. His plan was to claim asylum in a Western country as an Afghan refugee. Being an Arab, he was directed in Afghanistan to an Al-Qaeda camp, but upon showing reluctance to train or fight, he was arrested on the suspicion that he was a Western spy. At the hands of Al-Qaeda interrogators, he was beaten and electrocuted and nearly drowned in a water tank. Eventually, he confessed to plotting to kill Osama bin Laden on the orders of the CIA and the Mossad, Israel's intelligence service. This landed him in a prison in Kandahar, in a cell not far from John Muhammad. Following the U.S. invasion, Al-Janko was handed over to U.S. soldiers, who consigned him to Guantanamo. Eventually, a videotape surfaced of his coerced confession under Al-Qaeda torture. Yet Attorney General John Ashcroft, eager to demonstrate progress in the war on terror, played an excerpt of the tape to journalists, without audio, as an Al-Qaeda martyrdom propaganda video. Most Guantanamo Afghans have by now returned home, but some still remain. Perhaps the unluckiest of this lot is Hamidullah, who has been accused of such a litany of misdeeds that you might conclude he is the world's most dangerous terrorist. American authorities asserted that he was aligned with extremists linked to the National Islamic Front, which was in reality a moderate pro-U.S. Mujahideen party of the 1980s that counted Hamid Karzai as a member, and which was largely defunct at the time of Hamidullah's arrest. He was also alleged to have associated with Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, the Taliban leadership, Pakistani intelligence, Iranian intelligence, and Al-Qaeda. He was said to harbor ties to Mullah Izzat, a pro-U.S. commander, Warlord Samud Khan, from an entirely different part of the country, and Zulmay Tofan, another pro-U.S. commander. He was accused of supporting the Afghan king, whose very post the Taliban and Al-Qaeda strongly opposed, of being linked to Warlord Ismail Khan, Karzai's U.S.-backed electricity minister, and of meeting with Taliban leader Saifur Rahman Mansur, who, you may recall, was killed in Operation Anaconda in 2001, 2 years prior to the alleged encounter. The prize of the most outlandish accusation of all, however, should go to the charge that Hamidullah maintained links to a commander named Haji Almas. This was in fact true, but Almas was no terrorist. He was a major U.S. contractor who played a key role in building Bagram Airfield and earned millions in the process. Thus, Hamidullah gained the ironic distinction of having been imprisoned in Bagram, in part on charges that he was linked to a man whom Washington had paid to build the very prison in which he was held. In Kafka's In the Penal Colony, a savage tale of detention on a tropical island, the condemned are forced to lie prone on an extravagant execution machine that etches such commandments as "honor your superiors" into their backs. Prisoners are never told the charges against them. "It would be useless to give him that information," an officer explains. "He experiences it on his own body." The process was no less surreal for Afghans like Mohebullah, a bus driver detained in Uruzgan province, whose Guantanamo file says, "Reasons for transfer to JTF Gitmo, to provide information on the following." Detainee's file does not indicate why he was sent to JTF Gitmo. In fact, U.S. soldiers had mistaken Mohebullah's home for that of a Taliban leader. When they stormed it one night, Mohebullah had fired into the darkness, thinking that they were thieves. Nonetheless, his internment remained a continuing mystery to all sides. Appearing before a panel to present his case, he said, "I am very happy to be in the tribunal, because for the past 1.5 years, nobody asked me any questions. My father keeps writing me and asking why I am not coming home. What should I write him?"
The tribunal president responded, "I am sure it would be difficult to answer that for you. The people that knew you, that could say you weren't Taliban, would not be relevant. Right now, we have no accusation against you that says you were Taliban."
Mohibullah would remain in Guantanamo for nearly 3 more years. In the vagaries of this system, you survived one way and one way only, through the ruthless exploitation of everyone around you. There was no getting around it. The broken alliances, the faltering hopes, the rude exposure of foreign agendas all dictated a certain logic of duplicity if you planned to remain alive and free. Warlord Haji Zaman spelled this out for me one evening poolside at the Intercontinental, one of Kabul's 2 luxury hotels. He wore rimless gold glasses and sported a pristinely coiffed beard, a look that belied his adventurous past as a commander in eastern Afghanistan. In December 2001, when Osama bin Laden and hundreds of other Arabs fled to the Tora Bora Mountains along the Pakistani border, Zaman had pocketed huge sums of money from the United States for his services in hunting them down. "The Americans came to me because they knew only I could get the job done," he said, raising a glass of scotch to his lips. He sat stiffly straight, a Kalashnikov leaning on one leg. On either side lolled a pair of bodyguards, who seemed to have had a few too many. The tinkling of a piano filled the air, and Western women dangled their feet in the pool. "This whole land," he said, sweeping his hand across hundreds of tiny house lights studding the mountains around the city. "This whole land is filled with thieves and liars. This is what you Americans have made." He ordered another round. "I know this game. I know how to survive." He was slurring his words by now. "I went to the Americans and said, 'I can find bin Laden.' I told them, 'Give me $5 million and I'll bring you his head.' So they went and talked to their bosses and arranged it. And I got $5 million. Then a few days later, I went to Al-Qaeda and told them, 'Give me $1 million or I'll turn you over to the Americans.' So they gave me $1 million. And I convinced the Americans to stop the bombings for a little while. I told them we could use the time to find Osama, but really, it was so those Arab dogs could escape to Pakistan. Then I went to the ISI, the Pakistani Intelligence Agency, and said, 'Give me $500,000 and I'll give you Al-Qaeda.' They pulled a gun and told me to get out of their face."
Zaman laughed. A long, raspy laugh that pushed his bodyguards into peals of delight.
"You see, they don't play this game. You can't buy them."
I asked Zaman whether he worried that all the conniving would catch up with him. After all, he had accrued his fair share of enemies, including the family of the late Vice President Abdul Qadir, whose assassination he was widely believed to have plotted. He clasped his hands.
"I have nothing to be ashamed of. I fought for my country. Only cowards and foreign agents have to fear, not patriots, not the people who survived all of these wars. We are true patriots."
A few months later, a suicide bomber entered a crowd of government officials and dignitaries, worked his way up to Haji Zaman, and blew him to bits.